This interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with John Warrenchak. How are you, John?
Very well, thanks, Chris.
Excellent, excellent. You're the winemaker at Litmus Wines.
I am indeed.
And Litmus Wines is, what are you, a contractual winemaker?
Litmus Wines does a number of things. It's based at Denby's in Surrey, and we're Denby's are a major client of ours, and we are responsible for making and selling their wines off-site, so that they do their own selling on-site. We also consult for another English vineyard.
Which one's that?
Redfolds. Okay. And we import some wines, Chris Ringland for one from the Brosa Valley, which is pretty cool stuff, and Gert Stepp and a few others. We make a range of English wine called Litmus, which is pretty well distributed around the UK in restaurants and some, and Marks and Spencers and Waitrose. We import and distribute biotechnical products for the UK wine and cider industry, which consists of yeasts and bacteria.
Yep.
Probably do a couple of other things I can't think of at the moment.
I know, that's quite a diversified range, isn't it?
Yeah, we also have a joint venture in a South African winery in Franschhoek called Mon Rochelle. Mm-hmm. And we're responsible for all the production and sales there as well. And that's a joint venture with Virgin, the Virgin Group.
Not Virgin Wines, but Virgin.
No.
Because Virgin Wines is almost a completely separate business, isn't it?
Yeah, this is Richard Branson's personal companies. He has Virgin Limited Edition and Virgin Management Limited. And they own a number of sort of five-star hotel properties around the world, from Morocco and South Africa and the Roof Gardens in Kensington, which is recently closed, and a few other places around the world, Necker Island and all that. And Mon Rochelle is one of them, and it's a boutique hotel, restaurant, vineyard. We're involved just in the winery operation. So we're a joint venture partner in a company called Mon Rochelle Winery Limited.
I'm interested because you also do the selling of the wine. Most winemakers, you know, they'll have you do appearances and do wine tastings, but they don't always necessarily get stuck in it for a contractor anyway, because you think of a lot of contractors that don't always...
Yeah, well, the bit that I left out of all that, obviously we do contract winemaking, which is quite a large part of our business. So English vineyards bring in grapes to us here at Denby's. We crush, ferment and bottle them. And give them back their bottles, either labelled or not, and do contract riddling and disgorging and sparkling winemaking as well. But yeah, Litmus Wines it provides sort of business solutions for the wine production business, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
On top of that, I have my own company called Warrenchak Wine Services, which is a consulting firm, and currently I'm consulting for wineries in Mexico, Israel, Russia, obviously South Africa. But that company, which is basically me, has worked in pretty much every winemaking country that I can think of, apart from maybe Thailand, and actually not New Zealand either, funnily enough.
Oh, okay. Oh, you missed some of the good countries. let's see how you got into the wine industry, because I understand you started out in Australia. You're an Aussie boy.
Yeah, from Adelaide.
Adelaide, yeah. Is that where you learned to do winemaking, and who did you initially work for?
No, I was at Adelaide University doing geology, and finished school, and just up the road was Petaluma Winery, with Brian Crozer and Tony Jordan running it at that time. This was their first vintage in 1977.
Okay. Brian Crozer is quite a famous Australian wine producer.
Very famous guy. Yeah. A very good thinker, very deep thinker, and projected his philosophy in the late 70s and all throughout the 80s. You know, had a major impact on the psyche of the Australian wine industry, certainly in terms of trying to understand why great wines were great and what could be done to sort of emulate, you know, sort of that greatness, and what needed to be done in Australia from a technical basis, which was the first time. Because I think before that, you know, the wine industry was full of old white men that had long lunches and weren't trained, but just making wine and not really not
being very professional in the process.
Striving for improvement.
Yeah, and he sort of started breaking it down into chemistry and biochemistry and you know, along with Dr. Tony Jordan, who's also quite famous in the wine industry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they set up a course in Wagga Wagga, which I ended up doing, but I was at Adelaide University and just doing vintage work and cellar work, cleaning the outside of hoses because I wasn't qualified enough to clean the inside of hoses at Petaluma. I did that for a couple of years. And then through Jordan and Crozer, he said, well, you've got a Bachelor of Science. You can use most of your subjects, all your maths and your chemistry and everything, and go to Wagga and do a winemaking degree. And so I had a rock in one hand, a bottle of wine in the other, and just thought, well, you know, one's much more interesting than the other. Yeah, so yeah. I went off to Wagga Wagga. And so it was a good opportunity to, A, get 1,000 kilometres from home, which was, you know, at that age is something you would do. and do a course, you know, do the winemaking course, which was at that time pretty unheard of. My parents weren't particularly pleased with me at the time because, you know, winemaking wasn't considered at that time a proper job.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did it anyway, spent a few years at Wagga. Meanwhile, I was, you know, during holidays and everything, I kept on going back to Petaluma, working in the winery, bottling and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then got my first job at, first proper job as assistant winemaker in Rutherglen Campbell's in 83, I think.
What, making Muscat?
Yeah, yeah, that was fun. Yeah, with Colin Campbell. And we used to go, in those days, it was $3.50 for a flagon of sort of Bill Chambers, sort of 20-year-old Muscat. It was ridiculous. I mean, the whole place was just crazy. But I mean, in those days, all the old guys were still, you know, Dick Buller and Bill Chambers and Mick Morris, and just all the legends were all there. And every second Tuesday, I think we would get together at Mrs. Hoppy's for in Cowra for a winemaker's dinner. And it would be, you'd have, the first course was fish and chips and the second course was steak and chips. That was every time, that's what you had. But you'd end up with these sort of 100-year-old muskets, and it was just fantastic. Really good.
Cool.
Vigneron's dinners, they used to call them.
Really? Yeah. Fish and chips and steak and chips.
Yeah. And so you have some old Shiraz and some Shiraz, as they say, and Jurif and that with a steak and maybe an oxidized Riesling for the chips, and then end up with lots of good fortifieds. Yeah, nice. So it's good.
How long were you in Rutherglen?
About 18 months.
Oh, okay. Not too long, though. No. Did you do a couple of vintages or?
Yeah, two vintages, straddling over 18 months.
Oh, okay. And then what happened after that?
Worked around a bit in Australia. I did vintages in Yalumba, mm-hmm. Saltrams.
Yeah.
And then in 1985, I decided to do a vintage in California, which at the time there wasn't a huge traffic in, you know, winemakers and cellar hands and whatever going around the world like there is now. There was not many people doing, a few had done it. I wasn't first, obviously, but one of the first to go around and do that kind of thing. So I worked at Clos du Bois in Hillsburg, and that was pretty good fun. I guess the way I got into it, into working for myself, was I did that vintage in California, and then told the winemaker towards the end of harvest that there was a whole lot of safety issues in the winery. The electrical systems and the way they did things weren't really safe, and things that we were taught not to do in Australia, and, you know, how to organize things. I just told him that in passing. He said, well, write us a report. And I said to him, well, if I'm going to write you a report, I'm going to have to charge you for it. I'm going to do it for nothing. And he goes, okay, how much? $200. Seemed like a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he said, oh, fair enough. So I did it and wrote this report for him, and he gave me $200. I thought, well, this is better than working for a living. You know, you go around and learn more, and where I can, you know, set up my own company to charge for my services.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I set up something called Harvest Wine Consultancy. Not very original name. And then did for 6 years, I think. Just travelled Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, doing the flying winemaking sort of thing. And it was great because you can make enough money in those two seasons. And in between, I was with my girlfriend and our wife then, and we'd stop in China or Indonesia or India or Eastern Europe or something on the way back to the UK.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to spend, you know, 3-4 months in the UK, 3-4 months in Australia, and 3-4 months travelling for 6 years, which was pretty good.
Cause, nice, yeah.
Well, I kept on, you know, honing your skills as well as pissing about.
Yeah, yeah. like it. And so, but you based yourself in the UK. When was that?
I think 1991, I permanently based myself here. Before that, I was doing the travelling, and I got a 1988 was the first vintage I did in the UK, and that was at a place then called Thames Valley Vineyard, changed its name to Valley Vineyards, and then more recently to Stan Lake Park.
Oh, Stan Lake, yeah. Okay, yeah, Stan Lake Park, name I recognise.
Yeah, and with a really nice old chap called John Layton, who's still about and still exactly the same as he was, a really interesting guy, very much into grape growing, and had a lot of viticultural trials going on in those days because there wasn't as much information of how to actually grow grapes properly in this country.
I was going to say, moving from Australia and California to the UK, climatically very different, but also probably evolutionary, because wine making and wine wasn't particularly sophisticated.
Well, it wasn't. Tim Atkin asked me in those days, and he's used the quote, he stopped using it now, but he used the quote a number of times for years going forward. And he asked me what it was like to be the best winemaker in England, and I said, well, it's like being the best downhill snow skier in Saudi Arabia. And he used that quite a bit, but I managed to single-handedly offend every single winemaker and grape grower in the United Kingdom, to the point where I remember Kit Linder asking me, how's the skiing, John? Well, I didn't know what he was talking about. But anyway, after I did that first harvest in 1988, I went to New York State just to have a look at a really cool climate viticulture, because they were ahead, probably a decade ahead in those days. So, and they were growing things like Sauvignon Blanc and stuff that we grow. And probably our climate now is similar to what their climate was then, because it's definitely warmer here now than it was when I started. And so I did that, and then set up contract winemaking business at Stanley Park, which was pretty successful. And I had about 13 English vineyards I was consulting to around the place.
Well, that's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, in those days. All the way from Somerset, Devon actually, Sharpen Vineyards, and then Somerset, and Moore Lynch, and all these old names, and Pilton Manor. Don't know if most of these places don't exist anymore, but a few of them do. And Hambledon, in fact, which is now...
Hambledon, yeah.
So there was a Harvest Wine Consultancy, which was all that was consulting to 13 vineyards and doing contract winemaking. And then I set up something called the Harvest Wine Group, which contained these 13 vineyards who all paid in, and it was a joint cooperative marketing venture, mm-hmm. which we employed a person to sell the wines. And we did quite well. We got wines into a lot. I mean, threshers in those days, and wine rack and bottoms up and all that. We sold lots and lots of English wine to them. But sadly, it just they were keen, and they bought it, and they liked it. It didn't move off the shelf.
Really?
It was just a bit too early, I think. Yeah.
The wines were okay?
Yeah, the wines were good because I knew how to make wine. Because, everyone else in the UK was... sort of an old doffing type colonel or, just hobbyists. And and there's no reason. I mean, still today people think, I can't just go and do law. You know, there are things that you need to know, and basically in those days they were all, it was quite very Germanic, and they were all harvesting with grape harvesters. So they'd crush all the skins and the seeds and the grapes together in this mash and then pump it into a press and then press it all out, pressings included, oxidize it in the tank for 6 or 7 months before bottling, and then they'd add some sugar and put it in a hock bottle with a Germanic-looking label on it and call it Reichensteiner and expect it to sell, and it was basically undrinkable. It was just high acid, high sugar, swill. After I went to New York, I bought a whole bunch of English wines to taste and, just to get a grip of what's going on, and just couldn't get any information out of it whatsoever. I said, well, we wasted a whole couple of £100, which was a lot of money in those days, buying every English wine I could. I think from Carl Kernan, a lot of it. He used to have a store in London.
Who?
Carl Kernan. He had an English wine shop in West London.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day, which was probably quite insane when you think about it.
Yeah.
And I bought a whole lot, and I just realized, it didn't matter whether it had Schoenberg or Reichensteiner or Bacchus on the label. It just all tasted like shit.
All right then, John. I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much.